Tim did a great job of summarizing the argument. And he, if you haven't read the book, I think he's really capturing the essence of the first couple of chapters. And then there's one third chapter where these are lectures. When I read this, I remember thinking, who cares about some green book in the so-called green book in England? You know, okay, this is a strange way to start a book. There's some insight there, though, that Lewis is recognizing that larger currents in philosophy and the way people think and their sort of what one philosopher calls social imaginary are inculcated in the little daily practices in the way that we speak on a daily basis. Not only that, though, the Green Book is actually significant more than I thought, because it really does represent, though Lewis doesn't go into this, probably wisely, it really does represent the modern social imaginary, the Enlightenment social imaginary. So this book, believe it or not, is really a massive critique of modernity in some important ways. Now, Lewis and Tolkien, I suspect, would have loved to go back to the Middle Ages. That's not possible. I don't think he's actually advocating for that. But what we do have to be aware of is what has happened in the way that we think and speak and what it means for us and what its logical outcome. Now, to try to say why have these things happened is a really tough question. And I don't think anyone's really answered it. Why has history taken the course that it has? We can say why in the sense of this happened and that happened, but why? Couldn't it have been otherwise? I don't know. There are great books on why modernity has come to have these features that are embodied in the Green Book. Charles Taylor's A Secular Age is one of them. Some of the works of Alasdair MacIntyre. Some of the French Nouvelle theologians in the early and middle 20th century are really wise on these things. Basically, a lot of times it comes down to the Catholics blame the Protestant Reformation for everything. The reality, though, is a lot of the things that started happening in modern thought were a fruit of late Middle Ages as well, and the rise of a thing called nominalism. If you know Duns Scotus, you'll associate that. But anyways, let's not talk about why, let's talk about what has happened in the modern period. And one of the things that Lewis is getting at, or the key thing that Lewis is getting at that's happening in the Green Book, I would call the fact-value distinction. So it's not pure relativism in the sense that we think of that. That's not interesting. Like sort of radical relativism that, you know, you think 2 plus 2 is 4 and I think 2 plus 2 is 5. Okay, no one believes that. But what's happening is there's this split now, that there are certain things that are in the realm of fact, so that this exists is fact, and we can know that and measure it in mathematical things and certain kind of objectifying comments about it. But then there are things that are value. If I say this rail is good, is a value, and you say, well, that's your response. You're saying something about your emotions toward it. But that's not something that you can have in the realm of fact. So this starts really back with David Hume. And you have this sort of privatization in Hume's skepticism. And what happens, though, and it continues in all these thinkers, Kant, it's part of the whole modern thing. What happens, though, is that true knowledge is purely descriptive. So I can describe, right? And anything prescriptive, this is how we ought to use this thing, this is how we ought to feel about this thing, becomes speculative, projectionist, and relative. Hence why we can think of this in terms of moral relativism. But I want you to see the nuance here. It's rooted in some deep philosophical things. I've often thought that if I were to go on a university campus and I wanted to preach the gospel on a soapbox, what I would do is I would preach Friedrich Nietzsche first, and I would not preach Jesus right away. That might sound blasphemous. I think Nietzsche is right about saying this is what you've bought into, fact-value distinction in certain ways, and he says But you're still living in the thing, this whole slave morality, as if you have to like be subject to these other things. And Nietzsche says, hasn't humanity seen that we created the morals and they're ours and we can triumph over them? Hasn't humanity become free? And he writes comically, but I think seriously, about how he is like the man of the future. He thinks, look, they just haven't, it hasn't all dawned on them that we are the masters of this moral universe that we've created. And so I think when you start to see that and people start to think through it, there's something frightening actually about it and its implications. And we do have a Nietzsche expert in this room, and I know badly simplifying and maybe even getting something wrong, but we can argue about it later. And I think the point of Lewis's entire book is, especially as we go beyond what Tim summarized to the last chapter, is to take us to, this is where this is all heading. And let me show you where it's heading and forestall it. So, fact-value distinction. This stuff is central to the modern education project in another way. And the reason I say that is not because modern education started out like, oh, we want to make everyone moral relativist. But no, the whole university system is built on just the objective factual knowledge. This is the modern project. And this is why our research universities are always trying to be value neutral. And there are some great things to gain by this. I'm not saying they should all be Christian in that way or whatever, but they're attempting to be value neutral. And what happens is it creates a vacuum of, it creates a system of utilitarian purposes, because if all this is value neutral, this becomes a tool for me to know about, to master, and to use as I wish. And the university, which is where the greatest thought in our society is going, the finishing school of our children, is not giving us any parameters for how we ought to use this. It's saying we choose how to use it. It is a tool within our toolkit. This thing, the environment, whatever it is. And so one of the things that Lewis is calling us to with the Tao is that this is actually new about our modern period. What I'm talking about here, this value-neutral, objectifying place, this fact-value distinction, it is something new to modern society. He says that every past culture operated within the Tao, that there is a sort of obligation to things. There's an obligation to the world, that we are not fundamentally masters of the world. We are fundamentally responding to an order that is given in the world. That I have a responsibility towards other people, towards this object, to find out what it is and to use it in accordance with what it was intended for. One simple way to put this is, in the modern period, we have stopped asking the ultimate why. What is a thing for? We ask all other whys, like what is it made of? We ask what made it that way? What is the agential cause? But we stop asking the question of the final cause, what Thomas Aquinas, taking from Aristotle, talks about in natural law. Final cause, what is it for? And so he says every other age was asking that question of the final cause. And as Tim pointed out, if you suspend the question of the final cause, the task of the educator becomes one of deconstruction, or what Lewis calls debunking. Basically, you have to weed out value statements. Value statements are subjective. They are probably that person trying to make a power play and put their will onto other people. And so you weed those out, and the whole task of education becomes getting down just to the facts. And so what happens in this scenario is that you either seek to empty students of value judgments altogether, or you will decide arbitrarily on encouraging certain sentiments without having any ground in the cosmos. You'll just have to choose them according to your will as the educator or the institution or the society. And so Lewis is saying that is in fact what we end up doing. For Lewis, what happens is this attempt to make a purely rational person, causes this shift in anthropology that's supposed to happen. You are supposed to have received sentiments, which are feelings or emotions, that are trained, that there is a right way to respond to this kind of situation, that puppies are cute, that sex means this, that for procreation or whatever it is. And Lewis is saying we're ripping those out, and we've got just the facts, and we've got the belly, the appetites. We're men without chests. And he says there's a very, very important role that the trained emotions and sentiment play in the governing of our lives. They tell us how to feel about things as we're learning them. Let me read page 24 and 25, well, in my book. He says this: without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless against the animal organism. I had sooner play cards against a man who was quite skeptical about ethics, but bred to believe that a gentleman does not cheat, than against an irreproachable moral philosopher who had been brought up among sharpers. In battle, it is not syllogisms that will keep the reluctant nerves and muscles to their post in the third hour of the bombardment. The crudest sentimentalism about a flag or a country or a regiment will be of more use. We were told it all long ago by Plato. As the king governs by his executive, so reason in man must rule the mere appetites by means of the spirited element. The head rules the belly through the chest, the seat. So what he's saying there is the mind is supposed to be at the top, reason, but it's got a particular type of strength. Its army, its real muscle, is in the emotions. And when that is cut out, it can't control the appetites, and the appetites take over. And so we become what we would call in moral philosophy emotivists, those who respond primarily as right to what they feel or desire. So Lazar is saying this is, I think, really important to where we are in university life. The things that are taught in our schools at primary and secondary levels really matter. But university is this finishing school where we go to learn the high theory of the values that have been learning in practice for years. It should be not a surprise to us that when students go to university after being trained in these practices of ways of thinking and speaking, that they go and they learn the theory behind it all and they abandon their faith. That happens in a large... It's not because university is so bad in itself. It's because they've been groomed and prepared for this, and they come into it and goes, this makes perfect sense. And also I would say the church hasn't done a good job of countering this. So it's not just to say there's a big bad world out there. What the Augustine Center and the work that we want to do is we want to bring the Tao back to the university. So we want to bring this assumption that there is a cosmic order into which all the disciplines of the university fit and to which they are responsible. Now, Lewis calls it the Tao. We would call it, as Christians, the Word of God, the incarnate Word of God, the Logos. But I say the Tao, and I stick with that because one of the things that I see important is to actually expose to students that they already are in a tradition. That being part of the modern world is a tradition itself, and that it's a broken tradition because it's a tradition that says it's not a tradition. It's a vapid tradition. And then one of the things that we want to do with our work with university students and educators is actually not just prescribe onto them, here's this tradition and deposit that you have to download upon them, but to actually encourage them to inhabit these other traditions, to invite them into inhabiting a tradition, principally the Christian faith. We think it's the best, but I think a Christian Studies Center can have fruitful dialogue with Muslims and people of other faith who are going, we inhabit a tradition that is given and that can be helpful. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That we're we're trying to do that. And so we think that in the debate and dialogue between traditions, as one gets out of this empty tradition that says it's just the facts, and you have real interfaith dialogue and digging into the Christian tradition, we think Jesus is present and that he works there and that he shows up. We also think that Christians can learn from people who are within the Tao in other places. It doesn't mean a saving knowledge. We think we can learn things that are coming from those other places in that what I would call a conflict of traditions, not a bad conflict, that good things happen. So, Lewis goes on and on a lot about the problems with the modern situation that the Green Book is laying out. I won't go into that too much, but I've already kind of said some of this, actually. I'm not following my notes very clearly. I'm sorry. One of the things, though, that I want to say as well about what we're trying to do is Lewis talks about training emotions. He talks about inculcating sentiments, teaching ourselves and other people how to feel and how to respond. Hopefully you do that with your children, right, if you have them. My wife and I are in the process of adopting children and foster children. And you can bet I'm going to teach them that the Los Angeles Dodgers are the best team in baseball. They will learn that is true. I'm not going to just let them choose on their own. Well, we need to give people a plan. And how am I going to do that, by the way? I'm not just going to tell them in theory. I'm going to show them how good the Dodgers are. We're going to watch the game together. We need to...
include what's the last World Series?
Yeah, we lost two in a row. This is really painful. So,
no, it wasn't.
Austin?
Yeah.
One of the things a Christian Studies Center wants to do, and I would say churches and youth ministries, we're teaching children about how to respond to the world in light of the gospel. And that is not just intellectual. It involves practices. It involves relationship and togetherness. It involves the emotions. It involves the appreciation of beauty. And so one of the things we are attempting to do in building a brick and mortar institution near Georgetown that is focused on university faculty and students is to create a center of hospitality where people can come together and taste and see and have their desires formed. This is where maybe Tim and I will part ways a little bit, not part ways on anything, but I think you're seeing people come to liturgy, and especially Anglican liturgy, in new ways, because it's not just intellectual. It has intellectual content, but it's actually practices that are forming the heart. And this is like not just, you know, some of you guys maybe 20 years ago, you might have felt like, oh, we're getting older, we're all going to die off, Anglican. And now you can read, you know, this guy out of Calvin College, James K.A. Smith, who's writing about the importance of liturgical practices for spiritual formation. Even a lot of my Baptist friends and non-denominational friends are like, can I have a copy of that Book of Common Prayer so I can use it in my services? So we're rediscovering this. And so one of the things we want to do is create a place for people, not just in an Anglican way, but to practice these things and have spiritual practices in their lives, because the gospel is, you are receptive to the rationale of the word of God and its teaching when you're being formed to love it. And those two things go together and they can't be taken apart. I'm almost done, I promise. Lewis talks about at the end of his book, he has some really fascinating things to say about the outcome of all of this, where this goes. And it's really, really fascinating. I mean, he talks about how, but one of the premises is, you know, man is thinking with technology. He's writing in like 1940 approximately. Man's thinking with technology. It is about to conquer nature. And he says, rubbish. He says, all this is every time humanity thinks it's conquered nature, all it has done is it's
usurped rulership over other parts of humanity by means of nature. And so he talks about, you know, these technological advances. He's not against all of them. What he's saying is that we have, as we've inculcated this view that we are the masters of things, we are trying to grab mastery, but what we're really trying to do is own ourselves, our own species. And so the result of this, he says, will become these conditioners who will create the artificial Tao for us. And he talks about how, you know, at first, these conditioners who are running the society of the future, who have realized, oh, the Tao is artificial, we created, at first they'll be motivated by this duty to do good for humanity, right? But then they'll kind of dawn on them, like, wait a minute, we're the masters of this. Why do we have a sense of duty over it? And so there will start to be the reality that they can either just kind of keep perpetuating that system, or they realize they can have no sort of system at all to perpetuate in others, to inculcate, or they will inevitably, because there can't be just that vacuum, they'll just perpetuate the values that are in accord with their own desires. And he's not talking, he's very careful, he's like, I'm not just saying we're all going to be Nazis or live under fascism, that this is what will develop, even in other guises. And it's, in essence, he says, all that is left to chance, and nature ends up, the passions and desires that aren't trained or ruled by the chest overcome reason, and we get sort of mastered by our own nature. And so he goes on a lot about this. He says it much better than I am doing right now. But he basically says this is the way that the academy and other powerful institutions in society become these instruments of oppression, really. And one of the things he does at the end of this is he actually calls, he says, now, you might think from all of this that I am against science. You might think I am against the academy, against the applied science. And he says, no, far be it. But what we need, he says, is a new science, a new natural philosophy. He says, maybe what we need will actually come from the academy, that science itself will essentially repent. That it will realize that it indwells this larger, broader sphere, and that its task is to receive the givenness of things, to be responsive to the world, to discover the order and respond appropriately. Maybe it will have this sort of epistemic humility that it has not had in the past. And so he really says he wants to call the university itself to redeeming the culture, by inculcating this new desire. Now, we don't hope with our little center that we're trying to found to take over the university, but what we want to do is we want to cultivate Christian scholars who approach things in this way, who have this kind of epistemic humility, this passion for knowledge for its own sake. I think that's actually been lost, believe it or not. We say passion for knowledge sake. Really what we mean is we want knowledge for power. That's the trajectory of modernity. Whereas the Christian should be able to do this, and other people in the Tao, in theory, should be able to do this with a sense of wonder and reverence and responsibility. And so we're not just trying to do a campus ministry at Georgetown, we're trying to create a center where people can learn to do scholarship as Christians, because the universe itself cannot do it. It is too committed to the silo of neutral value objective knowledge, and it has to be at this point, society. We don't want Christians to leave that space. We want them to form guilds and communities within it where they can exemplify this and do the best scholarship in the best way. So I've been talking about sort of applying some of the insights of Lewis to what we want to do. I've been saying we're working on this Augustine Center. We, being Jim, Tim, myself, are at the very beginning of this project. We've been talking about it for a long time. We have about a dozen faculty at Georgetown that are really excited about this idea, that are excited to be connected with one another because we've met them and they say, I mean, there are other Christians here? I mean, who are they? I want to meet them. We're silent. Students are excited about it. I think they recognize right now there's great work being done on the evangelism and Bible study side. We think that's the most important. We don't want to mess with that. But even the campus ministry groups say there isn't this kind of theological integration and this sort of Christian scholarship side of things that's happening at church. It's not there. And they look at the model that we've outlined and they say, this would help so much. The other thing we think is really important about what we're trying to do is campus ministry at Georgetown is so transient. There's actually only a very small community of people at the school that follow Christ. We did a fairly educated guess and found out about 7,000 undergraduates. There are about 200 that are involved in campus ministry there. Okay? We want that to change. But campus ministry is hard in that context. It's a hard part of town, really, just for the gospel. And so what we're hoping to do is to build a lasting institution that can give some stability to these other campus ministries, that can be a hub for the things they do. We think institutions matter, especially in a place like Georgetown. So right now, what we're doing is we're working on some... Sorry, Father Carlton, I'm just explaining who we are. We're working on founding documents for the Augustine Center. We have some hope that we will somehow, someday, by God's grace, be able to get a building near the campus. That's you all are the Georgetown people. You understand what a miracle that would be. But we're praying and hoping that will come to pass. And in the meantime, we're starting small. We're working on for next year a fellows program that we can take. Hopefully about 6 to 8 students and start getting them together once a month with bringing in a Christian scholar from all different fields, not just theology, but science, Christians who are scientists and other academics. And where they're going to learn to be Christian scholars. They're going to learn theological integration of whatever they're studying. They're going to create a dense network, what sociologists call dense network of scholars, because we think the network is really important. If any of you have read James Davison Hunter's book, To Change the World, he talks about, you know, Christians, we think we just need to throw money at politics or we need this sort of one great person. He's like, all the change that we've seen societally when Christians come in, it's not, one, it's not generally through political realm, and two, it's not individuals. It's actually these dense networks that get created around these things. And so that's what we want to start doing is over the years creating this dense network of students at Georgetown. Last thing I'll say is our model for this, in case, I assume a lot of you have never heard of a Christian study center. This is an established model that is going at about 24 universities. The granddaddy is at UVA, where James Davison Hunter is, actually. It's been there for about 30 or 40 years. And if you know anything about UVA, it has an incredibly rich Christian presence on that campus and in that city that is different because the Christian Study Center has been there over time. It's not a fast change that this affects, but it's a slow change. So I've met students, UVA students, who they were looking at going to some Ivy League schools or this school, but they actually ended up going to UVA because it's a good school, but because of this Christian, this whole Christian presence. UVA is a state school that has theology, Christian theology taught in its classes in a way that other school in their religious studies department, that other places don't. So we're hoping that we're at the very cutting edge by our feeble, small efforts of somehow there being this thing near Georgetown that has changed the face of that whole area and has enriched the life of the university in a really dynamic way. And we think it's a long process. We're hoping maybe we're around to see like some of the fruit in 10 years, but I think we're looking at a big, long project. So that's all to say, I'd love to talk with you more about this idea sometime, and I'd love any ideas or feedback, or if you want to get involved in some way. We need people, we need resources. Talk to us. I think this is an exciting possibility for us. Again, thank you for having us. Would you like to ask some questions, or should we...